Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 44 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of George Miller's interview with the travel writer, biographer and translator Julian Evans. You can hear the first part of the interview in episode 40.
Hello and welcome to this Royal Literary Fund podcast. My name is George Miller, and this is the concluding part of my conversation with biographer, translator and radio documentary maker Julian Evans. In this part, we talk further about Semi-Invisible Man, Julian's life of the great 20th century travel writer Norman Lewis, whom Julian knew well. We also delve further into the purpose of biography and the biographer's obligations, and I also ask Julian what he reckons his subject would have made of his book. But we began this part of the interview with Julian giving me a sense of the richness of the early decades of Norman's life.
He went through some really wonderful eras. I mean, I won't say that the First World War, growing up as a child, was a wonderful thing, but in the 20s, he began to make himself as a businessman. In the 30s, which I think people don't really see as a fascinating era, and yet it was an enormously liberal era in which people could try out new things and invent themselves. Indeed, in order to get through those difficult times, the slump, the depression, people had to reinvent themselves. And that's what young men and women like Norman were doing. And then he happened to be in Cuba with his wife and their small son, thinking that the marriage had been perhaps an error, and war was declared. So with the most enormous relief, he left his wife and son in Havana, for their own safety, obviously, but was able himself to escape back to England and get involved in what turned out to be an enormously fascinating war for him. So all of these things were matters of chance and unpredictability. Nobody could have seen the way Norman's life would have been, especially if you think that actually he was one of the first writers in the genre in which he wrote, if you like. Well, I don't really like to think of it as a genre, who was not pretty much upper class, English, well-educated. Norman never went to university. You know, he didn't come from a country house. He didn't have smart friends. And he was the first, really. I mean, he was the first, if you like, everyman travel writer.
And was that part of the appeal to you? I mean, could you imagine having spent the years and lavishing the words on someone who'd come from a privileged background and gone to Oxbridge? And
well, I wasn't in the market for writing biographies. You've got to remember that. Although I loved writing it and I had a wonderful time doing it. I've met other writers of his calibre. I interviewed Patrick Leigh Fermor. I used to edit some of Paul Theroux's books. I've met Colin Thubron. I've published Redmond O'Hanlon. All of those people, I think one can say, were better educated than Norman and came from more stable, more well-off backgrounds. I think I wanted to write Norman's biography because I particularly understood, and not where he was coming from, but how where he was coming from chimed with where I came from. You know, the suburban escapist and would-be adventurer. Which is not to say that I don't greatly admire Artemis Cooper's biography of Paddy Leigh Fermor, or to say that I wouldn't have minded writing it myself, which I would. I thought he was a wonderful man and a wonderful writer. But, and this is again part of the vicissitudes of life, after I'd finished writing this biography, my agent said, "It's dead. Literary biography is over. Don't give me a proposal for another biography, Julian." So I turned away from biography and the opportunity didn't arise.
Was there also an element of feeling that Norman had never really properly received his due, that the quality of his writing had been acknowledged among writers and in reviews, but he'd never really made the big time in the way that some of the other writers that you've just mentioned, and that by writing the biography, that was a way of really marking his claim to a place in posterity.
My feeling about that is that, yes, he definitely deserved a biography, if anybody did. But my manoeuvre in writing a biography was a blocking manoeuvre. At the same time, I thought, if I'm going to do this effectively, I have to do it for my own satisfaction. And my satisfaction was in communicating not only what an interesting life he'd had, but what a, to my mind, brilliant writer he is. He's a brilliant writer who perhaps is glorious in his own sentence by sentence way of writing revealing descriptions. But at the same time, there is this slight myth that's grown up around him, which is that he has never received his due. And whether my biography did anything or not to change that, you have to remember that he started writing in the 1930s. His first two or three books are not really available at the moment. But his first big success was published in 1951, and that book has never been out of print. I won't say all of his travel books are in print at the moment, but the majority of them are. I mean, I don't think you can really ever do enough justice to a writer like Norman, but I don't think he's been enormously neglected. Perhaps the biography helped. Certainly, it was part of my humble task, I felt, to try and send readers back to the books of a master.
And did you have specific things? You mentioned earlier his childhood and finding out things about that which hadn't been written or said before. But were there specific things that you really felt you needed to investigate in order to bring this book off that hadn't been explored in his own writing?
His marriages.
Because you quote earlier in the book, I think, him saying, in response to the question, how many times you've been married, he says, I don't really talk about that. I don't really speak to the family about the number of marriages I've had.
No, that's right. Yeah. He came clean about his early childhood and the bullying very, very late on in his life. And that did help to explain a lot about why he'd been sent away to stay with three mad aunts in Wales, why he was such a wary, watchful person. It was a determining thing for his personality. But at the same time, there was a kind of exclusion which made it difficult for him, I think, to form deeply insightful relationships with others, which meant that he had to learn on the job, as it were, much later on in his life. And it meant that he sometimes got involved with people, women, who, if he'd had those insights, he would have known were not the sort of people, the sort of women he should get involved with. It's not to say that he was an unlucky man who had two terrible wives before he finally met and remained with Leslie, his widow, who he was with for more than 50 years. But in the early days, his first wife, Ernestina, was clearly an instrument for his escapism. She was incredibly exotic. She was Swiss Sicilian, and her father was a mafia lawyer exiled in London. So she represented the escape through a relationship, which he also found through travelling. But there is, I think, no doubt that even her most loyal friends would say that she was something of an exhibitionist, very, very competitive, and someone who, finding that she was in Norman's shadow, found it the next best thing was to spoil the party. So that couldn't last. And then he had a wartime relationship, which one of his closest friends told him not to pursue afterwards, because it was a wartime thing, and it was obvious as an outsider that that's what it was and no more. But that went on for far too long as well. So it did mean that Norman had a slightly checkered, I mean, there were one or two girlfriends also, but Norman certainly had a slightly checkered emotional and marital life, which gave him six children, one of whom was, although he isn't anymore, obviously, a bootblack in Guatemala City. Norman was leaving traces and stories of his own all over the globe, and he didn't really talk about those. And I wanted to see just how much of that was reflected in the rest of his life. I don't know whether I did a good job. I didn't want it to be, you know, a kiss and tell or kick and tell biography. People could make what they wanted of Norman's behaviour. There's no doubt that he could be a very difficult man. He fell out with me just before he died, although I think that was partly to do with the Alzheimer's that had upset him and the way he felt towards other people. But despite being a difficult person, he was also an extraordinarily loyal and generous man, and kept writing great books till the very end.
And did you think about what he would have made of your book, or is that a question you just have to really sort of set aside?
I think that if I'd asked him, if I'd had the opportunity, which I didn't, to ask him if he would have liked me to write the book, I think he would have wrinkled his nose up and as if I was about to spoil my life, you know, rather the way he would have wrinkled his nose up if I'd ordered the wrong thing in a restaurant. Don't do it, Julian. Don't do it. Yet, I had a feeling all the way through that I wanted to write a book that, if he could have seen himself from the outside, he would have been more or less satisfied with. The thing is that I think Norman's great contribution to my way of looking at the world is that he showed me that reality is subjective, that everything that we look at is an act of composition. Yes, there may be such a thing as objectivity, but it's probably only the consensus of a lot of different subjectivities which are similar. We make the world up as we go along. I think once you start to look at the world like that, it's enormously liberating. That was what Norman gave me, I think. And to that extent, I don't think he could have looked at it objectively. But my idea was to write a homage to a friend that tried, I think one of the reviews put this very nicely, that tried to prove that his values were not an affectation, that there was great authenticity, both in the man and in his writing. Whether he would have noticed, liked or appreciated that, I don't know. I know that his wife, his widow, Leslie, read the whole typescript as she was invited to, it being a biography that was sanctioned by the estate, and she didn't ask me to change anything. And there's plenty that's revealing about, you know, the downside to being Norman. I think the best way I can put it is that I did my best to give him another kick into the future.
For listeners who may not have read anything by him at all, where would you advise him to start? What would be sort of maybe your top three recommendations for Norman Lewis books?
I think that he wrote four or five really great classics. One is his wartime diary of being a field intelligence officer he was an NCO, in occupied Naples, called Naples 44, which is wonderful. It's a very good entry-level book because it's very conversational and it's full of extraordinary stories about that very extraordinary city and Norman's relationship with it. Then I personally love the book about Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos, A Dragon Apparent. But I think there are two other books that I might also mention. One is his account of the Costa Brava before the tourists moved in, which is called Voices of the Old Sea. And the last one is his own wonderful stab at a biography of himself, which is full of little bits of manipulation of the truth, and you can find out where and how if you read the biography. But that book is called Jackdaw Cake, and it's a glorious book from start to finish.
That's an interesting point you just made about the little manipulations of the truth, because that's something inevitably that you do as you go through. You sort of say, well, that didn't quite happen like that, or he rearranged the order, or he created a composite character there. What would you say the sort of overriding purpose of that process is? I mean, it's obviously interesting to see how a literary work comes from the life, but is there a sort of bigger purpose behind that? Because obviously one possible result is that the reader feels a bit sort of the mystique has gone from the literature.
I think readers have to make up their own mind. I don't think I can do any more to defend Norman or me or any other writer from the accusation that, you know, that we're economical with the truth or manipulative with the truth. I think that it's got something to do with what I said earlier, which is that when you write a book, you are making a literary object. You're not giving a blow-by-blow account. If you were, that wouldn't be very kind to the reader, actually, because the reader would find that a lot more boring. That might sound a bit like sophistry to say that, well, if authors didn't muck about with things, readers would be a lot worse off. But in a more positive light, I think I'd say that I think what writers do is something rather like what composers do with music, and that is that they have their main themes, they have their subsidiary themes, they have their scherzos, they have their solo passages, and that a composition works because it's a composition. It's not just flung together any old how. Themes come back, they're repeated in slightly different ways. I think that's what writers do. The raw material, when you do the kind of non-fiction writing that Norman did, and which I'm familiar with, is events, places, people. So inevitably, there are adjustments made. But I'm sure I'm paraphrasing somebody who said this before me. What you're really doing is telling a lie in the service of a greater truth. The excuse for that is in the quality of the composition that you provide.
I mean, I can see if you're writing a travel book, or obviously if you're writing a novel, or there are many genres in which you can probably say that's inbuilt. But if you're writing a biography, did you feel that the onus was much greater on you because you can't sort of say, well, I'll skip 1972 because that was a bit dull or whatever. You have a certain obligation to go through the entire life and try to give an account for everything of significance. Not day by day, obviously, but is there a heavier burden of responsibility?
But why not day by day?
Well, it's theoretically possible, because I suppose you'd end up spending the rest of your life doing it.
Exactly. You would end up, your life would then be the chronicler of every moment of somebody else's life.
You'd be more than Boswell.
You'd be sort of uber Boswell, but nobody would want to read you. You'd be regarded as a fanatic or some other form of extremist.
I suppose what I was saying was, does biography impose particular obligations that are unique to it, or perhaps it has similarities with history, but what other genres are less burdened by?
Well, I think biography was burdened by its own objectivity for a very long time. Now, I knew Norman, so I could, in a way, I had a license to insert myself to make it a more subjective piece of work. And occasionally I did. I think there's a phrase somewhere in the middle of the book which the attentive reader will have immediately understood the significance of, where I say, let us not get lost in the long tunnel of chronology. By lost, I meant bored. And by bored, I mean exactly what you're talking about, which is that Norman lived till he was 95. He had an enormously varied and interesting life. And yet, to go day by day by day, or month by month by month, I wouldn't probably have lost the will to live, but I'd have lost the will to write. So I think that the constraints that biography imposes on you are simply constraints that you ought to be honest about. You know, my honesty came in the form of sometimes wondering whether I should have said as much as I did, whether I should have included my own falling out with Norman at the end of his life, which I don't regard as very serious. I mean, it was very hurtful to me when he put the phone down on me and made it clear he didn't want to speak to me again. But I felt that that was a full part of a life. I mean, the trajectory of a life is, and I don't want to fall into a melancholy note, but it has a sadness about it. We lose our vitality, we slow down, things go wrong, people spend the last decades of their lives penniless or bedridden, or, you know, and yet not to talk about those end-of-life difficulties, for example, would not be to do justice to the full story.
Counterbalancing those sadnesses and challenges in your life of Norman, it's clear that he did keep living, really, you know, living in the fullest sense, because so often with biographies, you know, the final decades are just a few pages, perhaps for very good reason, because very little was happening. But he did remain, as you say, he remained writing right up until the end, and living in all sorts of ways.
Yes, and I think that's what justifies being able to talk about the difficult moments, particularly with Norman, because he published his last book posthumously. He was writing right up until the last 18 months. He was travelling in northern Guatemala at the age of 86, sleeping on floors, going on horseback. He had the most amazingly full life.
That was Julian Evans in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Julian on his website at www.julianevans.com. And that concludes episode 44, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 45, we have an audio diary from the non-fiction writer John Kay. In My Writing Week, he shares a week in which he lets go of a completed book and begins to contemplate the next one. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.